I'm stepping up unexpectedly. Okay, gives me great pleasure to introduce Rick from Santa Maria.
Hi, my name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Gus for inviting me and the secretary for having me speak here. It's always a privilege to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. This room is very important to me and very sentimental for the simple fact that when I first got sober, incidentally, my sober date is January 31st, 2005. So I got 10 years, 5 months, and some change. But who's counting, right? And I'm the first one to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous does work and will change your life for the better if you apply it to your life. And I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. I see a lot of familiar faces in here, and that's always good. Like I said, this is the room where I got sober in some 10 years ago plus. So it's always a privilege to come back here and carry the message. You don't see me too much now because for the simple fact that I started a new position about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, and it was strongly suggested that because of the position I carry, I should go to meetings outside of my area. At first, I kind of balked. I wasn't really receptive to it like alcoholics are in the beginning, but that was my sponsor, and he suggested I start attending meetings in the Mesa, so that's where I attend. So if you haven't seen me in a while, I haven't went out. I'm still sober. Still have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I still contact him every week, and we get together on a weekly basis, minimally, if he's not out of town. And Alcoholics Anonymous works. It's good to see Jim and all Danny and everybody. These are my friends in recovery that were there for me in the beginning and continue to be in this day. They are great examples. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and share my story with all of you. Like I said, I sobered up January 31st, 2005, but I'll go back to the beginning, what my life was like prior to that. You hear a lot of speakers come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they give you, you know, elaborate stories of what their life was like in childhood and everything. I didn't have that bad of a childhood, okay? My mom was a single mother till I was about 9 years old. She was a hardworking woman. She worked in Santa Barbara as a nurse's aide. So and graveyard shift. So I didn't get a chance to spend a lot of time with her through those younger years. I can remember her always being at work and me spending like 2 days with her when I wasn't in school. I mean, after school, I'd have exposure to her. And then she got married when I was about 9 years old to a really good man. And I had an average childhood. I went to school, got in a little trouble here and there, and there was alcohol in the house, but nobody was drinking in the house. Like, where I didn't see people staggering around drunk. When guests would come over and visit the family, they would pour them drinks. And I kind of noticed as a child, well, you know what, when people start drinking this liquid or whatever, their behavior starts to change a little bit. They started laughing more. They started giggling. They didn't behave like they normally did. And I noticed it, and I made the connection right there, and I started telling myself, well, when they start doing that, started acting like this. And I see some people get really belligerent, like at barbecues and stuff, and I started thinking, God, if that's what that shit makes you do, I don't want no part of that. You know? And I meant that when I said that. I said, if alcohol makes people behave like that, I'm cool with that shit. But moving forward a little bit, you get into the eighth grade, I went to my first real party where there was alcohol flowing. And Ship Danny was probably there, who knows. But I remember what happened. They gave me a drink, and it was some type of punch type situation, and I took a drink, and I thought, oh, this doesn't taste a little funny, but it, you know, I started drinking. What I noticed what happened was everything seemed really funny. And the music, as alcohol always did, the music sounded better. I found myself able to socialize and bullshit with people on levels that I didn't even know existed within myself. I thought, well, you know, the social lubricant, right? Anyway, my mom came before I got too drunk. There was a knock on the door, and you know, when you're in eighth grade, you're trying to be cool. You think you're hip, slick, and cool in this shit. When they knock on the door, and somebody say, "Hey, Ricky," they call me Ricky back. They say, "Hey, Ricky, it's your mom." I said, "Mom, I will never be able to socially rebound from that statement." I thought. So I come to the door. She goes, "Come on, you're coming with me." And I'm like, "Well, I'm not." She goes, "Come on, you're coming with me. Have you been drinking?" And I said, "Oh, I had a couple of things that might have been you." So she was pissed off. I got into a lot of trouble. She scared the shit out of me. I didn't want no part of alcohol or going to parties because I got grounded. I lost all privileges that I had, whatever privileges I thought, TV, bike, going out to my friends or whatever. I couldn't do it. Next year rolls along. It's ninth grade. I wanted to be part of a certain group that weren't really popular in school with the administrators and what have you, and they would be throwing parties. I'm almost sure Danny was probably at those parties, not to throw him under the bus too much. But I went to my first party, and I completely blacked out. I got drunk. I could not handle my alcohol for shit. I blacked out. When I went to school Monday morning, everybody was talking about, oh, you were all fucked up, Rick, and this and that. If I'm using language to defend you, I'm sorry. I don't know how to say it any other way. So I was all thrashed at the party. Everybody's clowning the shit out of me on Monday morning. And you think I would learn my lesson to some degree. Next weekend, I'm partying again. I'm a complete blackout. Every weekend, it seemed like in the first couple of months of high school, I was blacking out continuously. I would start to drink, and I just couldn't stop. And I would go until they were picking me up or dragging me to my doorstep. And I didn't think that there was nothing wrong with that, other than everybody was just talking shit to me, clowning me, and telling me that this is, you know, I was the guy that always blacked out. So I had a remedy. I told myself, okay, I'm not going to go through that shit the next year in high school. I got to start to develop a different type of an image, right? So what I did is I went to parties and everything, and everybody, the beer's flowing and everything. I filled up my cup, and then I would go, and I would pour a little bit of it out to pretend I was drinking, and I just wouldn't drink because I wanted to be somebody that could maintain their alcohol, had an image to protect, or at least I thought I did. I wasn't shit. So I did that my sophomore year, my junior year. I started partying my junior year. I went and I started drinking. I took about 4 or 5 beers and I thought, okay, this is cool. I can drink maybe 4 or 5. I thought I'll try. This is me, the first stages of trying to control my alcoholism. I drank 4 or 5 beers. I thought it was okay. I would go home and I would have 4 or 5 beers, sometimes 3, in my dresser. So when I wanted to call a girl, I would drink 3 warm beers of Budweiser in a bottle, and I would get on the phone. After dialing and hanging up about 5 or 6 times, by the time, and I was one of those drunks, by the way, used to call people and then sober up and they say, oh shit, I used to go spill my guts. Emotion, major embarrassing shit. But in high school, this is what I used for courage. And I thought I could maintain it. And when I was working, at the time I was working at this place called Howard Johnson's off of Main Street, and I'm drinking during the day, during school. I'm drinking after school in my room, but I'm thinking I'm maintaining it. And the normal kids don't, and 16 years old don't do that kind of shit. And then one day at Howard Johnson's, my manager tells me, hey, Rick, I need to talk to you after work. I thought, oh, I think I'm in trouble. He goes, go ahead and get dressed, and after you get dressed, I need to talk to you because we had to wear these little outfits. I was a busboy and dishwasher. And I went up to his office. I said, yeah, Brian, what's going on? What do you need to talk to me about? He goes, I need your help tonight. I go, well, why'd you tell me to get dressed? You know, I was in my work clothes. I go, what do you need me to do? He goes, I need you to help me drink some beer in the bar. Do you want to? I said, yeah, man, for free. He goes, yeah. He goes, I'm in charge right now because the bartender manager is gone for a few weeks, and I'm in charge of closing down the bar. So I thought, mean you can go in there and drink some. We could only drink the draft beer. I go, I don't give a shit. That's fine with me. I mean, I don't need no conditions. I'm down to drink. So I'm doing this continuously with Brian because I work Monday through Friday after work from 5 to 11 at night. While drinking at school, while drinking on the weekends, now I'm drinking with my boss after work. This is truly where I think my alcoholism took off and never really stopped. It just gained momentum from that point. I don't like to glorify the drinking a lot, so I'll move ahead. As I got older, I continued to drink. Drinking affected me in all areas of my life, okay? Relationships, jobs, family, everything. Everything was touched, and not in a good way, by my drinking. By the time I was out of high school, I was living with my girlfriend. I was never home because I was always out drinking. I caught my first case because I was one of those smart-thinking drinkers. When I was 18 years old, me and a buddy from work were out drinking one night. As usual, we didn't have a lot of money, so we were drinking the cheapest beer that we could buy. That ran out. I had a fucking brainstorm, I'm proud to say. He goes, what do you want to do? I said, well, I got an idea. We can go. This is what we used to do in high school. We can go to this store, and we'll just run in there, and we'll grab a bunch of beer, and we'll run out with it. We used to do it all the time in high school. We were so broke before, we were drinking just the cheap beer and the Thunderbird, I think, that night. Thunderbird played a big role in that night, I think. So we were drinking Thunderbird and cheap beer, and I came with the brainstorm to do a beer run. We did it in Arroyo Grande on Grand Avenue at that 7-Eleven way going down there. Well, anyway, what we didn't notice, I had my girlfriend, this dude who was this punk rock type dude with a little, like a 73 Beetle or something, driving. Me and him are going to go in the store, come back in with all this beer and take off. Me not scoping the situation out, across the street was a sheriff or a cop or something. So they witnessed the whole thing. They didn't even need witnesses. We get back in the car. We're going down the street in his Volkswagen, laughing, and we got all this beer. They say, here, I see lights. Like, what's that? Well, there's a cop. And I look next to him. I go, hey, John, check it out. I go, we could outrun them. Go. He's just as drunk as I am. He believes it. He's jamming. We're flying down the streets in the back of AG. Next thing I know, we run into a house. We, right, I mean, to the living room of the house. house. We hit the house, and I remember the lights coming on in the house, and I could see a person. I go, what the fuck does he want? You know what I mean? We just crashed into his house, and I remember being the good boyfriend that I am, the first thing I try to do is get out of the car and flee the scene. Self-preservation kicks back. At this point, it's everybody for themselves. I thought, I didn't even think of thinking about my girlfriend in the back seat, okay? So I get out, I try to run, they pepper spray me, they tackle me to the ground, I ask, I need to talk to my girlfriend, that I found out at a later time that apparently that night I proposed. In the midst of everything, how could she turn me down, right? I have so much to offer. I'm in handcuffs, I'm crying, I got pepper spray all over my face, and I say it's a good time to, I'm on both knees anyway, right? I might as well ask her if she wants to marry me. And I didn't know this until after the fact. So I was in a complete blackout. I remember coming to in San Luis Obispo County, and they were clowning me because I had these charcoal gray Argyle socks on because they took my shoes off. And he was, what kind of socks are you wearing? I go, they're Argyles. Don't you guys have any taste in clothes? And I remember I called my mom. I called my mom and I said, check it out, I got arrested for doing a beer run in Aurora Grande. I need you to bail me out of jail. And I'm pretty much pleading with her. And my mom was in this program. I had a deep despise for anything associated with AA because it's all she talked about and shit. Apparently she was in the program. I didn't see her drinking growing up, but she identified as an alcoholic, so who am I to say different? So she goes, I'll bail you out on one condition. I go, what? She goes, I need you to talk to my sponsor's husband. I go, those people in AA, hell no, I'm not going to. She goes, well, then stay in jail. I go, wait a minute. Well, all you got to do is talk to him? She goes, all you got to do is talk to him, and I'll bail you out. So I said, agreed. So I get bailed out with a charge, and I meet with this guy, and he was a very nice guy. I went to his house, and he didn't talk anything about what I was doing or how I'm doing. All he did was share his experience with me. But he was talking on really deaf ears. I didn't want to hear it, and that was just the first case where my drinking affected my life, okay? I was 18 years old. I was already getting busted. To fast forward, relationships lost, jobs lost. I catch numerous felonies, okay? I'll fast forward to when I was, 30-something years old? Because I don't want to talk too much about my drunkalog. But what happened was I was in another relationship, and a girl wanted to break up with me, go figure, because, I'm drinking and using and doing a lot of things I shouldn't be doing. And first thing I do is I go buy a bottle of vodka. And when the bottle, because I'm through with beer already, the bottle of vodka got about this much in it, all right? It got about that much. And when the bottle of vodka gets that much, fear starts to creep in me, and I think I need another drink. I don't want that bottle to run out. So what I did was, I need to go get another bottle. So I figured I'd go to Vons. Quick, simple, they got a big selection. There's cheap vodka there, even though I try to stay in that medium range when I have money. Well, I'm staggering in that store. I put the ball on the thing. They pretty much, get the hell out of here. We're not going to sell to you. You're obviously, if you're not in a blackout, there's one right around the corner. It was very obvious. I was in bad shape right there. So I walk out the store, and I walk around the other side. I say, look, if you're not going to sell it to me, I'm going to rip it off. And when I'm real drunk, I think I'm pretty stout. I mean, it's invisible. So I go around the back corner. I'd rather be watching me the whole time. I walk out of the store. The manager approaches me. I try to fight him. And as much as I like to sit here and tell you that I beat the shit out of him and all the box boys or whatever, they beat the shit out of me. Okay? They beat the shit out of me. So the first time that I ended up going to prison, when I rolled up to that yard, it wasn't for some hard shit like I'm this hard-ass gangster. It was for stealing a bottle of vodka, petty with the prior, because I've been doing this shit before. So I go to prison, and I like to say I learned my lesson, but I ended up, before it was all said and done, I ended up doing like four terms, three violations. Everything behind it is behind alcohol and drugs. Nothing glamorous, okay? There's no organized crime with me and this and that. And the last time I paroled was in 2000, in September 2004. And the only thing I didn't do different that time that I paroled, when I'm looking at the thing, is I didn't let my hair grow out. Every time I used to get out about a month and a half, I'm going to let my hair grow out. Yeah, but I always went back. I don't know what the correlation was. So I get out. In September 2004, my whole life has been nothing less than a train wreck up to that. I give you a couple of stories to kind of tell you the kind of alcoholic and other thing that I identify am, and I think I qualify. And as much as I like to tell you that I got out that time and came straight to a meeting and did the right thing, I did, and I started drinking right away, started using, doing all the things that kept me going back. But thank God on January 31st of 2005, something happened. I was drinking the night before and heavily using, and I was staying at the homeless shelter, and I was reduced to just one pair of clothes, is all I had to my name. No money, no keys, nothing. I didn't have an ID. I didn't have a Social Security card. I didn't even have a wallet. I didn't have nothing. Well, they found me in a pretty bad, depleted state in one of the staff offices, hiding under the table, thinking people were coming to get me, and there was nobody there. You know, this is the places that my alcoholism takes me to. And I remember one of the workers goes, "Rick, you have to get out from under the table." I said, "I have no place to go." He goes, "Where can you go?" I go, "The only place that would want to see me, and maybe not even them, is going to be the parole office. Can you take me to my parole officer? I need help." And about 4 or 5 days before that, I was in just as bad shape, but I found myself walking into some church, and there was a prayer box. And I remember writing something on a piece of paper saying, "God, I am so lost. Can you please help me? I need help." And I don't know what that looks like, but I just dropped that prayer in there, and I said, you know, it couldn't hurt, right? Well, when I go to parole, they their first response is to take me and lock me up. And they said, "Put some cuffs on him, take him to the substation. His parole officer is not here." And I thought, "Well, these lousy bastards." I came forward and I tried to be honest with them, tell them that I got a problem. I'm not telling them anything that they didn't know. The only difference this time is I was admitting to it. That was the only thing difference in this equation. And I thought I was making some big breakthrough, you know, like they didn't know. And so they took me to the Santa Maria substation, some place I was very familiar with. I'm sure none of you have ever been there. But when you get there, they make you take off your shoestrings and all this other shit, and they have this little ritual that you're signing this paper. And I remember those two parole officers sitting there bullshitting, laughing about what they're going to be doing after work. And I said, "Well, my whole fucking life's going down the drain. You guys are talking about your bullshit lives or whatever." I felt offended. You know, and I remember when the deputy goes, "Now, have you had a seizure in the last 24 hours? I'm already lying most of the time anyway, so I look at them two talking shit, and I say, "You know, as a matter of fact, I have." They say, "Oh, okay, we can't take him. You have to take him to the emergency room. He has to get medical clearance before you." I'm not in no rush to get locked up. I'd rather sit in the fucking ER any day for a couple more hours before you put me in jail. So I remember the parole officer Marcos was like, "He's a fucking liar and this and that." I wanted to laugh. And this and that. They go, "Well, I don't care. We can't take him as long as he's doing this." So Marcus, on the way back, he's driving. He goes, "Fuck, I'm not taking him to the ER. He can go wait his ass until his agent gets here." Well, when my agent finally got there, he took me in his office, and he told me, he goes, "You know, Rick, I wasn't going to leave you down there, man. I was going to go get you. I was just out in the field doing some things." And I said, "I know." He goes, "So what's going on?" I go, "I need help." And he goes, "Okay." He goes, "I'm going to send you to detox right now. I want you to get over there." He goes, "And I'm going to send you there, and I need you to stay there." I go, "I got no place else to go. I got no place to go. They have a bed, they got food, they got showers there." He goes, "Yeah." I go, "That fucking is a lot more than I got right now. The place looked really, really good. I had never even been there." And when I got there, I walked over there, I went in there, and I thought there were cops in the detox at the time. I thought there were cops in the meetings. They were bringing me to meetings, and it took me about 2 or 3 days before I started to really get some rest and the fog to clear a little bit. And I was sitting probably in this very room, I think, and I remembered that prayer that I had said the week before, you know, telling God that I was so lost and I needed some help. And I looked around the room, and I had steps and people talking about spiritual shit I didn't understand. They were just talking a little bit about drinking. They were talking about more how they're living their life today, and none of this shit could connect with me. I couldn't wrap my head around the spiritual aspect of this program. And I just thought to myself, I said, this can't be the answer to that prayer. God, please, don't let this be the answer. And when I said that to God, I meant that. I truly meant that. I go, "God, I don't, the steps and sponsorship, the fellowship, this can't be, there has to be an easier way. This shit doesn't even sound like it's going to work." You know, and at the time I really believed that, because what I want to impress upon you, prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I have failed at everything in my life that I've ever put any type of effort into. Everything. Jobs, relationships, families, you know, you fucking goldfish, you name it. I let you down before Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't worth this shit, and that's how I felt. So I'm supposed to come in here where people are talking about the business. There seems to be some type of work involved in the program. They're talking about steps, obtaining a sponsor. They're talking spiritual principles, commitments. All shit that I'm oblivious to. Commitment? Mm-hmm. The only thing I was committed to myself was to myself. It was to getting loaded, a head change. And I wasn't even very good at that toward the end. You know? But I came here because the one thing that I was convinced was that my way wasn't working. I knew that beyond a shadow. I didn't need no convincing on that. I don't know about your way. Jim and all them were here when I drove up, and they were talking deep shit, in my opinion. I couldn't understand anything he was saying. But when I was in detox, there was a girl there who I guess she liked me, and she seemed serious about the program, okay? And I left detox after 3 weeks, and in a relationship with her, because now I thought that I needed somebody in my life, because I'm not using anymore. I have a whole 3 weeks clean and sober, so I have a lot to offer, in my opinion. And then you guys laughed, but I believed that at the time. And what she told me was, she goes, check it out, Rick. We could be together and this and that, but if you go out and use, we're done. I said, Rob, like that? She goes, yeah, it's like that. If you drink, if you use, if you leave the program of AA, we're done. So I wasn't motivated to stay sober or work steps or get a sponsor because you guys were attractive to me. It was something else that was motivating me, and I'm sure you guys can figure out what that was. So, but everything played a role in my life, so I went ahead and got a sponsor, and it was only in name. I never really contacted him. Once in a while, I would call him. I talked about working steps with him and this and that. I would meet him for a meeting occasionally. But what did become out of that relationship was about, I started getting 3, 6, 9 months sober, no reading the book, no working the steps, no service commitments, nothing that resembled a program of recovery, mind you, but I wasn't drinking or using, and I was doing it more to appease the girl. But one day he took me to, he told me, I need you to meet me on Sunday morning at a men's stag meeting. And I what's a stag meeting? He goes, that's where there's only guys there. I go, well, why'd I want to go to a meeting like that for? You know, these fucking meetings are culture enough. Now I just got to look at a bunch of Jews. I've been doing that in prison for a lot of time. I don't want to fucking do that now. But he goes, just meet me. We'll go have breakfast after. So I said, okay, I guess I'll go. And at the meeting, what happened was there was a bunch of men, and one of them was this guy right here, David Jones, who ended up being my grand sponsor, a man I have a tremendous amount of respect for and love. And I went to this meeting, and there were a bunch of old-timers like Dave and all these dudes there, Mondo and all them, and I was listening to these guys talk just around a large wooden table at the Knights of Columbus thing. I go, this shit really sucks. I don't know much, but I know I don't like stag meetings, I'm thinking. And then we all went to breakfast after, and we're talking and this and that. So this started going on for 1, 2, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and somewhere into the fourth or fifth week, we were all having breakfast. And there was this guy at the meetings I really didn't like at these meetings, right? There was a guy named Esteban. He was always fucking guy talk like he knew everything all the time. I just thought he was too confident. I didn't like him. Well, he told me, hey, Rick, what step were you on? I go, I don't know. I think we're on step 3 or 4 or some shit, you know? And he goes, would you mind if I get together with you to help you work these steps? And this is in front of a table full of people, right? So I go, yeah, I guess I'd be all right, you know. I didn't want to say hell no, that's what I wanted to say, but I said, yeah, that's okay. He goes, okay, give me your number and I'll give you mine and we'll get together. And he looked at my then so-called sponsor. He goes, do you mind if I get together with Rick? And his response was, well, shit, if you can get him to do anything, I'm all for it. I caught an immediate resentment against him. I said, well, that motherfucker, no wonder I didn't ever call him. You know, he talked shit about me in front of a table full of dudes. So anyway, Stefan started calling me, picking me up, and just picking me up like on every other night for a meeting. I was like, fuck this guy. I thought he had a crush on me or something. Picking me up all the time. And then finally, after about 3 weeks of this shit, I said, no, I don't really feel like going to a meeting today. I went to work today. He goes, so let me get this straight. I'm going to drive from Nipomo. I'm going to pick you up. I'm going to take you to a meeting, and then I'm going to drive back to Nipomo. But you don't want to do this? I go, well, you are doing a lot. I get that you're going out of your way, you know. I said, okay, I'll go. This went on and on and on. And then something happened to me in my recovery about a little under a year. I went to work that day, and they told me that they were laying me off. And I never had any real loss in my recovery up to this point, and I thought, fuck, I don't know what I'm going to do. And Stefan said at one point, he goes, if anything happens in your life, I don't give a shit what time it is, I need you to call me that you don't know what to do. So I got on the phone. I said, I lost my job today. He goes, are you okay? I go, you're going to drink? I go, no, you told me to call you. He goes, you'll get another job. He'll be okay. I go, if I can't pay my rent, I'm going to get thrown out. I'm going to be homeless again. He goes, are you homeless today or right now? I go, no. He goes, is your rent paid this month? I go, yeah. He goes, well, let's just stay into today. He goes, I want you to go home. I want you to chill out so I get off of work and I'm going to pick you up for a meeting. I go, it's nothing to do. I need work. I need employment. What do you want for a meeting? So he picks me up, we start talking about my situation, and he tells me, he goes, you have some money saved, right? He goes, yeah, you got enough for next month? I go, yeah, I could swing that. He goes, okay, so you're okay for the next couple of months, right? He goes, yeah. And then he goes, I have some work if you might be interested until something comes up. I go, doing what? He goes, I need somebody to drive me around California. He's a professional man. He goes, and I have a lot of things going on in L.A., Bakersfield, Fresno, and I need to be able to be on the phone or on my laptop, and I need a driver. I go, you just fucking throwing me a bone or something? Because he goes, no. He goes, I need some help. Can you help me? And I said, well, I got to check with my house manager because I was in a sober living and see if it's okay if I go. And he goes, well, check. And my house manager goes, this is for your sponsor and this and that. I go, no, he's not my sponsor, but he's in recovery. And I can remember my first thing was, okay, I'm going to go on a road trip. It's going to be fun hanging out in nice hotels. I'm going to take all my music CDs and shit. And when I got in the car, he goes, what are those? I go, the music CD. He goes, no, we're going to be listening to speaker CDs. I go, speaker CDs? What kind of speakers? He goes, AA speakers. I go, fuck no. We got to go all over the place and listen to AA speakers? He goes, yeah, these are good speakers. I go, oh, shit. So I get in the car, and you know what? They were good speakers, and I do have quite the collection to this day. Shows me I shouldn't be talking shit about things, huh? So we're going places. We're going to Fresno, Bakersfield, Los Angeles, all these places. We're hanging out. We're speaker meeting out. We're finding speakers meetings out of town. And I remember he had a talk with me about right before I turned a year, and he goes, check this out. He goes, I talked to your sponsor. I go, yeah, how's he doing? And he goes, you know what? He goes, me and you've been getting together for a long time, and we seem to have a good relationship. Would you say? I go, yeah, I think we do. See, I was scared of rejection. I thought about asking him, but if he fucking said no, I probably would have fainted. You know? So he told me, he goes, you know, if you want, I would be willing to sponsor you, Rick. I go, I think I would like that a lot. I had now formed a connection and a bond with him. And come to depend, I was calling him every day. I was going to meetings all the time with him. I was going out of town with him all the time. And he goes, now you said that you and him were supposedly did a few steps together. I go, yeah. He goes, I go, we could pick up where we left off. He goes, yeah, sure, we'll do that. And he goes, but first, what I need you to do is I need you to read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go, why? He goes, how are you going to do a program of recovery without even reading the material? I go, well, you were going to help me. I thought, you know, I'm trying to weave in and out of shit, do things my way, not the program's way. And he tells me, he goes, look, we're going to be in Pasadena tonight, and we're not leaving until, I think, the day after tomorrow. He goes, I want you to read the big book. I go, when? He goes, I want you to read it tomorrow after you drop me off of my appointments. I go, all 164 pages? He goes, yeah. He goes, well, you're talking all this shit. You read all these books when you were in prison in one day. I go, well, fuck, I was in the cell. I'm not in the cell right now. And he goes, just read the first 164 pages by the time I get done. I said, cool. So I did it. I took the direction. I read it, and I picked him up. I remember I picked him up at his appointment. He goes, did you handle that? I go, well, I made the calls to you. He goes, no, did you handle what I told you to do regarding the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous? I go, yeah, I did. I completed the first 164 pages as you requested me to do. He goes, good. He goes, let's go back to the room. He goes, I want us to change. We're going to go work out at the gym for a little while. I don't want to do that, I thought. But I did it. We went, and then we got done working out. He goes, take a shower. We're going to go have dinner. And I remember before we went to go have dinner, I'll never forget this day in my life, because he went down. He goes, you did really good today, Rick. A lot of people never complete those first 164 pages. And he walked me out to where the pool section was in this really nice hotel in downtown Pasadena. And he goes, you see this pool area tomorrow? Oh, yeah. I go, I could be here tomorrow. I go, what do you need me to do? He goes, all I need you to do, Rick, is I need you to meditate on what you read tomorrow. I don't want you to order whatever you want to order on room service. It's all on me. He goes, can you handle that? I go, fuck yeah, I can handle that. It's not a lot better than any more reading he was going to give me. And then I said, do we get to start on where I left off on the steps? He goes, no, why don't we start from step one? I go, I did step one. He goes, well, let's just do it again. Start from the beginning. And that's where my journey truly began. So I like to tell you that I, like this lady that turned 36 years, I didn't touch the steps. It was while into the first, past the first year that I actually read the book, that I actually started, got a steps, the 12 and 12, and started doing the steps with the sponsor. And I didn't know about unmanageability and powerlessness until me and him went over that in my life. And I didn't know that when my life became unmanageable, I thought it became unmanageable with my lifestyle, with alcohol, but it didn't. It became unmanageable when I managed it. And the program taught me to turn my life and will over to the care of God so he could manage it. And when I start to unravel today, it's because I think I could shift back into the driver's seat and think I know what's best. And the program teaches me I need to get the hell out of the way. I need the program. And then the second step, it talks about being restored to sanity. I didn't think I was insane. I thought I was a guy that was shitting himself in the gutter or something. I didn't think I was insane. Well, my sponsor, he reminded me, he goes, I want you to think what your life was like 18 months ago. I said, I was probably in prison, or I was probably blocked out somewhere, or doing some other shit I probably shouldn't be doing, walking around homeless with no place to go. So does that sound like the same person's life? Hustling for alcohol and drugs and doing this all? I go, not really. He goes, what's your life like today? I go to work, you reel me into some damn meeting that I don't want to go to. You tell me to read the big book, you tell me to read the 12x12 and listen to speaker tapes. It probably sounds kind of boring. He goes, but does it sound sane? I go, it just sounds like there might have been some restoration going on. I didn't think about it that way. It took him to point those things out. And then when we got to our third step, I remember we were on the beach in Guadalupe, and he goes, well, how do you feel about hitting your knees with me right now? I said, that didn't even fucking sound good. you getting on our knees? He goes, I want us to do a third step together, the third step prayer together. And he goes, there's nobody out here at the beach with us, Rick. It's just us. Why, are you embarrassed? I go, it just seems kind of funny, too, man. You know, on their knees, you know. This is how the process was looking like for me. But I did. I got on my knees with him, and we said that third step prayer. And he goes, oh, he drove me back into town. We were at Guadalupe Beach. He goes, what are you going to do the rest of the day? I go, well, I was going to have you drop me off at the casino bus stop. And he goes, you're going to go to the casino right now? I go, yeah. He goes, okay. He goes, because I want you to take this with you. And I still have it on my desk at home. It's a little copy of the first 164 pages of the big book. And I go, what am I supposed to do? I'm going to the fucking casino. You're giving me a pocket of big book to take to them. He goes, well, you can read it on the way there and back. I go, this is going to sound like fun, you know? But this is him being a good sponsor in my life. And then he told me, because I want you to get ready, we're going to start step four. And the inventory, and I'm thinking, okay, we could do that. And at this point in my relationship with Esteban, everything was just turning okay, whether I liked it or whether it sounded good or not, because everything that he had instructed me to do up to this point seemed to be working. It seemed to be working to a certain degree, so I trusted him. And trust was hard for me, you know? So he goes, I want you to do it chronologically from what you can remember from the beginning all the way forward. He goes, if you have to break it down in 5-year increments, that's totally okay. So I remember doing that inventory. It took me all day. And I remember I was so excited to give it to him the following week. He goes, did you finish it? Yeah. I have kind of selective hearing sometimes, right? So I did what he told me. I remember when I got in his car, he goes, you finished it? I go, yeah, I have it right here. And he goes, and the fear and the sex inventory is in there? I go, fear and sex inventory? What are you talking about? I go, no. Fuck, you just want to know everything, huh? And he goes, okay. He has it back. He goes, give it to me when it's not done yet. I go, that's bullshit. You told me to do an inventory and I did it. He goes, no, I told you to do a thorough inventory. And that included a fear inventory and a sex inventory. I said, damn. So again, we went out. I was a little pissed off for a little while, but I said, okay, I'll do it. He goes, when are you going to have it for me? I'm going to have it next week for you. Is that okay? He goes, what day? I go, Sunday. I'll have it for you Sunday. You mean Saturday to do it. I remember I'm still saying it with the same pissed offness as when I was at the time. I go, I'll do it. I'll have it done by next week. Because I wanted to say I did that. So the next week, I got it done. I go, what now? He goes, well, because you have everything here, we'll schedule some time next week, and we're going to do your fifth step. That's why I share with him. And he took me to Walla Park. We went there early in the morning. We were there a little over 8 hours. And by the end of it, he was laying on the bench with his hands like this. And I was looking over, are you still there? That's a lot of shit. I said, you wanted me to do this, we could do this, you know. This is an all fucking day thing. You know, and I remember when we were driving out, he was, more will be revealed, right? I said, wait a minute, stop the car. He goes, what? I go, does it count? When I was in high school, we robbed the gas station and tied up the attendant. He goes, fuck yeah, it counts. For some reason, I think I left that out. And he pulls over on the way out of our park. He goes, did you fucking forget anything else? I go, no, I think I got it all. And then he took me to a church, and he goes, I want you to sit here. I go, why here? He goes, well, it's just church. You said you go to church sometimes. I go, very rarely. Okay. He goes, okay, I want you to sit and just meditate on everything that we went over today. And this is like, now it's coming up on, felt like a 10-hour day at this point. He goes, just for an hour, I just want you to meditate. So I did as he instructed. And then I got through that fifth step with him. And we moved on to step six, defects of character and our shortcomings in six and seven. I went through all the steps with him, but I want to touch more on when I made a list on step eight of persons that we had harmed. Again, it was a big sense of accomplishment for me, but when I handed it to him again, he told me, he goes, is your dad on that list? And I said, fuck no. We used to be Percos. I told him just like that, fuck no. How is he going to be on that list? He walked out on me when I was a baby. He was never there for me. You hear all the resentment in my voice still? When I describe how I talked that day, and he goes, then give this list back to me when he is on it. And I remember when the waitress goes, you guys ready to order? And he ordered this big old breakfast, and they go, what do you want? I go, I don't want nothing. I sat there like a child and pouted. And he ate, and I got more pissed off because he ate like a kid. I'm all pissed off because I got to put my dad on an inventory, and you're eating like it's the best meal in your life. I ended up including him, and more importantly, I ended up knowing why I had to include him. Because how I thought about him, I had a lot of hatred in my heart for him, and I was able to let that go through this process, the recovery, which is something I never thought I would be able to do in my life. So the program transforms us in ways we can't even imagine if we allow it to, if we allow it to work in our life, and allow the people in these rooms that come through the rooms to work in our lives, because we don't do it alone here. And I was able to continue. It talks about in step 10 to continue that personal inventory, and I falter on the promptly part, but I try to examine my life to the best of my ability on a daily basis and see what areas that I do need work on. And anytime I have these lapses of what I like to call brilliance or anything in my life, I bounce it off somebody in the program. Primarily it's my sponsor. And we've reached a point in our relationship where I could be in his car and I'm telling him about all this shit that's going on, and all he has to do over is look at me like that, and I'll say, I'm full of shit, huh? He just responds, he goes, well, at least you recognize it. I go, well, it's just the fucking way you looked at me. You were speaking very loud without saying anything right there at all. But he allows me to be me, and every time that I want answers in my life, and I used to get frustrated every time I go, I got this going on. He would tell me a lot. He goes, well, I don't know. Let's look in the book. Why don't you just tell me? Why do you have to tell me to read shit? Or why, you know, I mean, but he always lets me figure it out for myself through the book, or, you know, and he goes, I, as much as I like to give you the advice that I think you need, he always instills me the answers to all our problems. The answer to whatever we're going through in our life is in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything allows us to function in our lives in that big book. And then we got through the maintenance steps of the program. We're sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying for His will and the power to carry that out. I continue to do that in my life. I try to stay spiritual. Being spiritually connected is a big part of this program. Jim could recite the book verbatim, really great. I love that about this man. I am not as well-versed as he do, but I do love that chapter of the Agnostics where it states, the main object of this book is to enable us to find a power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem. I can say I did that through Alcoholics Anonymous. I have made that spiritual connection. I have that in my life, and I wouldn't have had it if it wasn't for this program, if I didn't allow it to work in my life. And the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening, part that it talks about working with others, I'm a selfish person, okay? If I find something I like to hold on to it. I don't want to give it away. After I had completed the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, completed them, Stellan dropped me off in front of this building right here, and he told me point blank, you know what? He goes, you have now completed the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everyone with a degree of formality, I want you to know that. And he goes, you've reached the highest level you can get. I go, I thought he was going to give me a medal or a pen or something. You know, because he said it with such conviction. And I said, well, what is that? He goes, you're sober. That's it? I'm sober? I've been sober. He goes, that's as high as we get in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's good enough. Because if I'm sober, the sky's the limit. The sky's the limit. Anything's possible. If you would have asked me 10 years ago what my life would be like today, I probably would have told you some pretty good things, but today it surpasses whatever that is. And like I said, when he dropped me off that day, he found out. I said, check it out. I go, I'm going to these meetings, and people are starting to come to me and ask me to sponsor him. And he goes, what are you saying? I'm saying, no. He goes, what do you mean you're saying no? I don't want to do that. They're going to call me, and we got to get together with them? He goes, listen, check this out. He goes, you've completed the steps in step 12. Now you carry this message. You take them through the steps just the way I took you through the steps. And again, it was giving me an opportunity to say, okay, you know, today my life is good. Like I said, it surpassed whatever goals I've had. I came into the program with one pair of clothes, no money, nothing, at the doorsteps of detox in pretty bad shape. And because of all you were there, I could look around this room and see all you people that were there for me, put up with my bullshit, always kept telling me to keep coming back. Today I have a responsible position in my life. I actually gotten married. I have a 2-year-old daughter. I never thought I'd have any of those things. Prior to that, my mom's been dead. My dad's been out of the picture. I thought I was going to die alone and die probably drunk. But God always has a better plan for me. So if you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you this program can and will change your life. I could tell you that with confidence and conviction because it's changed mine and countless others. With that, thank you.
Let's give Rick another round.